Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And it's like, this is, how have you ever read the Gospels, which are the complete antithesis? I mean, for sure, do what you can in the world. And if we, quote, succeed in a worldly sense, great. But his kingdom is not of this world.
Writer, Catholic convert, ex-lawyer, sober alcoholic of 33 years, Heather King discusses her faith, women, the communion of saints, Saint Thérèse of Lisieux and the Little Way, and more on Almost Good Catholics.
Welcome to Almost Good Catholics, a conversation about theology and apologetics. I'm your host, Chris Odinietz, and I will be asking interesting people who have thought about the big questions to share their conclusions, to explain what we know, how we know it, and why we think we know it. I hope this format, in relationship and dialogue, and back and forth, may help us approach the truth and to have a really good time doing it. If you should want to take the conversation a step further, I invite you to please email almostgoodcatholics@gmail.com.
Today's guest is Heather King. She is a writer. She wrote Parched, a memoir, in 2005, and she's written 12 or perhaps now 13 books. She writes a number of columns, including one for Magnificat and another weekly arts and culture column. She has been a journalist for NPR's All Things Considered, and she has a website, Heather-King. That's the little dash, the hyphen, Heather-King, that you can go to and read all of her writings and watch her videos. Heather King, thank you so much for joining us this fine, cold California morning.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here. I'm in Tucson, Arizona. It's cold here, too.
Oh, okay. What takes you to Tucson?
Oh, that's a long story. I'll probably write a book about it. I joke that I write a book about every single thing that happens to me, which, as you say, is maybe 12. But anyway, I'd been in LA 30 years, and the thumbnail would be, it was just time to go and open a new chapter of the journey. I still write for, you mentioned my weekly arts and culture column, and I write, and I hope I will for many years to come, for the Archdiocese of LA. So my part of my heart is definitely in Los Angeles always.
Okay. Well, I loved Parched. It is a brilliant tragicomical memoir. And I read it exactly when I needed it. And those of us, and I think that's got to be everyone, who make the same mistakes over and over again, as St. Paul wrote, I don't understand why I keep doing the opposite of what I want to be doing in Romans. We pick up your book, and suddenly we are not alone. And literature keeps us company in that way. And I thought I was a train wreck. But then look at this girl, my spiritual sister. So can you talk a bit about compulsion and sin and the problem that St. Paul describes? And you say Flannery O'Connor says we resist grace because we resist change. So what the heck is wrong with us humans?
Well, I think we have a story about that. It's called Adam and Eve in the Garden.
Right.
Somewhere along the line, and that's not to shift blame, but I think every human being gets, there's a fault line in my psyche somehow that I long to be good, I think, and to connect with people and to contribute. And then there we are. But first of all, thank you. I think after all this time, in a way, Parched is still my favorite, still forever my favorite. But it's no holds barred, folks. Mm-hmm. You know, it's life in the bars of Boston. But it's also very much, I had been a Catholic. I converted, I came into the church in 1996. So I'd been a Catholic for almost 10 years. And it's really a very Catholic book at bottom. It's a book about death and resurrection, mm-hmm. the death of that every addict, if he or she recovers, has to come to, the death of your identity. That is truly becomes your identity as an alcoholic, or it did for me. But this very interesting point that you bring up, of is obsessive compulsive behavior, which alcoholism, in my opinion, and from 20 years of experience with it, absolutely is. I mean, if you could stop drinking, you would. I mean, zillions of people die from it. If they could stop, they would. So something has been taken, your free will has, in a sense, been overcome by the thing. And I love about alcoholism that it is still a mystery. It's a mystery to science. It's a mystery to medicine. The only thing, interestingly, that I have found that works is a spiritual program that actually led me to Christ without ever mentioning Christ. So your free will gets overtaken. At the same time, something inside you, I think, in order to recover, it's some yes that you say, like Mary's yes, below the level of consciousness where you somehow, the God within you says, I want to live and I don't have any idea what my life would look like without booze or drugs, but I'm going to say yes to it. And all evidence to the contrary. I mean, because I didn't even really want to stop drink. I just figured I would drink until I died.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very mysterious. All I can say is something greater than me absolutely came in and removed that obsession. And that's just the beginning. It's like a conversion. It's like, okay, great. Now the real work begins. And so that's been the work of my life for 35 years.
There's also, I just remember when you write about the intervention that your family staged, there's something about relationships, right? When you go to rehab, it's about a group of people, a community of people. And I can hold my own life at small value. But when I look at my brothers and sisters, and I think I'm worried about them. There's something very Catholic about that, you know, improvement comes in community. Healing comes in community. Nobody can do it by themselves.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's something about, you know, there's that passage in the Gospels about if your brother does you wrong, you get someone else and go to him and speak about it. Like we address in community. And I think an the operative point about an intervention is honesty. All the people who've been walking around you, as we do often when someone has a huge problem, we pretend it's not there. We're afraid they're going to get mad at us. And an intervention says, we see how you drink and it's affecting us as well as, you know, we're worried about you and it's affecting us.
Yeah.
And so that your conscience, you know, I mean, you absolutely still have a conscience while you're drinking. You have to ignore it in many, you do ignore it in many, but it's there. And I think it's a kind of conviction where you can no longer pretend, oh, it's just my life. It's mine to ruin if I want to.
Right. Right, right, right. Okay, so and another irony, or I don't know if it's irony, another paradox here is that in humility, you know, we find strength. Back to Paul, right, who writes, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness. And then he writes, when I am weak, I am strong. There's something about that, you know, you hit rock bottom, the first step in those 12 steps is I am powerless. And then the reverse happens. Then you realize what happens? How does that work? The weakness and the strength in paradox.
Right. Yes, and you're so right. It's, I mean, just in saying, I'm an alcoholic is the same. In a way, that's the penitential rite with which we begin the Mass. I mean, what is the first thing we say during Mass? I'm weak and I need help.
Yeah.
I'm weak and I've gone off the path and I need help. And absolutely, we're powerless. We're not helpless. There's a huge, huge difference. And so I think that exactly that admission of weakness, that alcohol, it's the greatest gift of my life, that it really brought me to my knees. And I'm smart or smart enough. I had a law degree that I had somehow gotten while I was drinking. You know, but all the things that our culture tells us will avail, our intelligence, our drive, our ability to organize, our charm, our good looks, if we have good looks, it availed nothing. And so it was in my weakness. And it continues to be that way, that because when I can admit I'm weak, then something greater, again, that power of Christ's love that is infinitely greater than me, then that comes in and starts to, and then I get to cooperate with it in my bumbling way.
Well, is it that might even be a curse that you were able to get by for so long on your on your talents? You know, from in your memoir, you start off winning the spelling bee as a little kid, and then you have this narrative where I'm really good at school. I'm you know, like everybody knows I'm good at this, and so you can go through law school and graduate cum laude and everything, no matter what. And so does that preserve your illusion that you are, that you can do it on your own?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. and in fact, there's this kind of perverse pride. I mean, I joke that I would, when I, even now when I hear someone, you know, some young, you know, well put together person with good teeth and like an Ivy League haircut say, oh, I graduated from law school. And I think, yeah, I bet you didn't do it while you were wasted, dude. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like there's like a perverse pride that you managed to do it. And it's, you know, and sober, it's kind of like, that's not really something to be proud of.
Yes. No. And does that make it harder that we as a culture, we think drinking stories are funny, and I love your drinking stories, and when I have mine too, and I'm just very happy that I grew up at a time when there was no internet and nobody could take pictures that would last forever, you know. But like I still think my you know, my youthful shenanigans are comical, and when old friends get together, we talk about, oh, remember that time when this happened, and that was crazy. But we wouldn't talk about that, about other sins, you know, especially sins that are harmful to others more explicitly than they are to ourselves, and so on. So there's a problem there. I don't know what the problem is, but
well, if I can just say, I mean, I think part of the difficulty and the mystery too is that there are lots of people who enjoy drinking and sort of drink a lot, but they're not alcoholics. When push comes to shove, they can stop when they can. And look, but an alcoholic cannot, I mean, you could have your doctor say you're going to die of cirrhosis, and it's like you go to the liquor store 2 seconds later. Yeah. You know, so I think that's why, like, real alcoholics don't like tell war, you know, they tend not to. I think we have a very healthy sense of, you know, oh, that was a debacle, and we can laugh at ourselves. But yeah, exactly. It's not funny. But also that wine, look at the Eucharist, for heaven's sakes, has alcohol in it. I mean, so there's a purpose, a beautiful purpose for alcohol. Clearly, wine, it's meant for conviviality. It's meant for community. And the kind of satanic element of alcoholism, that it presents as that at first, and then it turns on you and becomes your master. So, and I think it's very difficult for people who are not alcoholics to even understand that. They can only, they feel how they drink, and so they just look at the alcoholic and think, put it down already, you know, but you can't. So.
No, that's really helpful. Is you're looking at this wondrous beast of alcohol on the end of this chain, and then you're wondering, like, which end of the chain am I on? Which end of the chain is the okay? So you describe the moment of like where you fall to your knees, visiting your friends. I think, was it in Georgia, somewhere beautiful,
Nashville.
Sorry, in Tennessee, and you're in the woods, and you feel you feel the hand of grace, and you compare it to some of the characters in Flannery O'Connor stories, and I don't remember which ones, but it makes me think of Mrs. Turpin in the one who's like at the end of Revelation, where she suddenly sees the stairway of all the souls ascending and the cosmic battle. And there's a lot of Flannery O'Connor in your writing, which I love very much. I mean, allusions too. And can you describe that? Can you describe that moment? And
yeah, and you're very right. That was kind of the seminal moment. And let me preface this by saying, to this day, I am so not a, the sort of quote mystics who subsist on the Eucharist for 40 years and get the stigma every Friday, and you know, the visions, like, that is so not my thing. Yeah. I come from New England, where it's like, no, you just work harder and that's how you get. And this was not a vision, but it was, what happened was I was just totally strung out. I'd graduated from law school. I'd passed the law, bar, and I just could not. I mean, I was a daily morning drinker. I was waitressing and getting fired now from waitressing jobs. So it's just, I think I was 33 or 4. And I went to visit these friends of mine in Nashville who had jobs and everything. They knew I was in trouble, but they invited me to come stay. And they were off at work, and I was drinking in the morning. I wandered into the woods, and I just had this moment where I was so exhausted. I sank to my knees. I was smoking. I sank to my knees beneath this tree, feeling sorry for myself. And I remember seeing these ants crawling along the trunk of this pine tree, I think it was, in the lichen. And I just realized, because I have a deep sense of wonder. And on some level, I realized I can't feel anything. I am utterly, I've been sucked dry of my soul. And at that moment, I just felt this, it was like a force pulling me down, sort of pulling me down to the netherworld. And in that moment, I had gone to Sunday school, Congregational Church, and I had not prayed since I was in sixth grade or something. And even then, probably not. And I prayed the Lord's Prayer. It was the only prayer I knew. And the words just like the atheist in the foxhole, our Father who, and when I got to deliver me from evil, I felt that to the core of my soul. I realized, I'm dying. If I drink like this, continue, I'm going to die. And I said the prayer, and then 2 seconds later, I was overcome with shame and self-consciousness. And I thought, what has just happened? Did I pray? Wow, I'm worse than I thought. And so I was not delivered at that moment, but I think maybe 3 months later, my family had the intervention. And to this day, I am convinced that was the answer, to my prayer. So,
thank you. Thank you. I'm going to ask you a question about a woman who has a lot in common with you in her love of God and his church, but in other respects is super different, and that is Saint Therese of Lisieux, about whom you wrote in your book, A Shirt Aflame, A Year with Saint Therese. And could you tell us about the little flower and the little way?
Oh, yes. Saint Therese of I'm looking at a picture of her right now that's on my desk. Deep companion, if anyone doesn't know, bourgeois French Carmelite, 1873 to 1897, I believe, was when she lived, and came from a very pious family and her mother died when she was very young, so she had a big abandonment wound, some other stuff. And she was sort of neurotic too, very sort of codependent, we would call it these days. Anyway, she had the call, and she entered, a lifelong virgin. She entered the Carmelite convent at 15 after appealing to the Pope himself, because that was usually the minimum age was 18. And she lived in the convent for, I think, a mere 9 years. She died at 23 or 24, very young. And in that short time, just she wrote under orders from her superior, who was her actual blood sister. She had three sisters with her in the convent, I think, two or three. And she wrote what we now know as The Story of a Soul, her spiritual autobiography. And this woman who was unschooled in the sense of she was very smart, but she didn't have an advanced degree from Notre Dame in theology or anything like that.
Yeah.
And she somehow got to the heart of Christ and of the Gospels in a way that has inspired and guided people all over the world. And her thing was basically, her heart just burned. She wrote the Apostles' Creed in her own blood and then folded it up and carried it next to her. Like, this is my girl, you know what I mean?
Wow.
Yeah, she carried it next to her heart. Yes, like in a little locket. Oh, yeah. But she was not nutty. She was not crazy. She was really, really grounded. And she was not into big mortification. She said, oh, I tried to maybe not slump in church. And she tried to smile. Her little way, it's partly doing little things for the love of God. She said, one of her great lines, to pick up a pin for love can convert a soul. But I think to me, the little way, it includes all of those kinds of things, you know, smiling at the person who absolutely raises your hackles or yeah. just drives you insane with their whining or their whatever. Can I treat that person like Christ? But her real, I think the little way is you don't have to have some huge charism. Maybe you don't. She didn't even know how to fix her own hair when she got in because they had maids in her home. Mm-hmm. She wasn't good at housework. And I think for those of us who we're just normal, ordinary, little people. We don't have great, maybe organizational skills, great leadership skills, great. I couldn't even be, didn't even have the vocation to be a wife or a mother. I shouldn't say didn't even, because those are massive vocations, but they weren't mine. And for a woman, that's a real sort of, whoa, what am I meant for then? And so Thérèse tells us you don't need to be special or have a special skill. Just form your heart to receive Christ and to love him. She was once asked what she said to Jesus when she sat before the Blessed Sacrament. And she thought for a minute and said, I don't say much of anything. I just love him. So that's Thérèse. Always makes me kind of teary.
Yeah.
And there's tons, there's just zillions of books written about her. I mean, that's kind of Thérèse in a nutshell, but there's all kinds of wonderful stuff about her.
So. Okay, but so she cuts right to the heart of like, she has been called the most popular saint, perhaps with St. Francis. She is a doctor of the church, you know, mm-hmm. along with guys like St. Jerome and Augustine of Hippo. And here's mm-hmm. this simple girl who died in her early 20s. Mm-hmm. And so I think, was it John Paul II who named her a doctor of the church? I think Pope Pius X called her the greatest saint of modern times. And so wow. there's something that people get about her. And I find it tricky to articulate. I've not read her Story of a Soul, so I only know about her from you and from other secondary sources. But there's a mystery, like a real mystery with a capital M, of what she figured out how early. Because something as simple as picking up a pen, we do that all the time, right? I'm a historian and an academic, but I never found those jobs forthcoming. So now I teach high school. And instead of being disappointed, I say like, wow, this is a real pastoral opportunity. Here's a bunch of crazy kids who, you know, trash the classroom every day and I can love them well and pick up after them. And, you know, and yeah. that's my little way. And I think anybody who's like stuck at home taking care of a baby, you're changing a diaper, that's your little way or so on. And is that, where's this... this wisdom that really resonates with everybody everywhere. How did she arrive upon it? Do you have any, I mean, you've thought about her for a long time.
Yes. Well, I think she had the, She just had that heart that at a young age, she had the pondering heart, the heart of in Martha and Mary. She had the Mary heart that sat at the feet of Christ. And I think one of the reasons she resonates for me is that in this culture that absolutely attempts to and is made great inroads into the church, to the church's great detriment. You know, the culture of power, property, prestige, success, get straight A's, get your degree in theology, know all the great chapels of the world, know the movers and shakers of the Catholic world.
Yes.
And it's like, this is, how have you ever read the Gospels, which are the complete antithesis? I mean, for sure, do what you can in the world, and if we, quote, succeed in a worldly sense, great, but his kingdom is not of this world. And I think Therese just gets to the heart of that without being polarizing, without saying your way is wrong and this way is right. She just goes to the heart. She's just very clear on how, on who she is, and that her gifts, such as they are very, very humble. And yet her heart, this is another thing I love about her. Her heart, she yearns to be a priest, a martyr, a soldier, a missionary. The world that tells all the women in the church, oh, you need to fight to be a priest, for example.
Yeah.
And Therese was, there's this great anecdote about her when she was on the way, she's on pilgrimage to Rome with her father. Literally, her goal was to appeal to the Pope himself and beg him to let her enter the convent at Carmel at 15. And so they're en route, and there's a bunch of other pilgrims, and there's a lot of priests, and she writes very diplomatically. She had a great sense of humor, too, in her journal. And she said, I saw then that priests need a lot of help. And I determined from that moment forward to pray for them unceasingly.
Yeah.
And it's like perfect. Let's pray. Yeah. And let's pray for if we have a problem with a priest or the, like, let's pray for them.
Yeah.
That's what you do as a follower of Christ. And you do it with a heart that has a sense of humor, that realizes, yeah, I have a lot of faults too. And God bless them. Look at them up there on the altar with all their faults and their humanity, trying to serve Christ just as I am. And then your heart opens to the whole thing. And instead of trying to jockey for power, you become a priest in that. And she totally got that. If your heart longs to be a priest in the true sense of the word, and you're a woman, in the true sense, meaning a shepherd, a pastor, a bridge, do it. You're surrounded by people who need help, whether it's your sisters in the convent, your high school students, as you just said, Chris, your neighbors, your fellow recovering alcoholics. Do it. Do in your daily life. It's all there. And because if you can't do it there, or you're unwilling to, you're not going to be a bridge or a help to anyone else.
No, just, it's so liberating, because, you know, we think I really need a scarlet cape, or I need a higher salary, or I need more letters after my name.
Or like 3.5 million YouTube followers. And it's like, you know, at some point it's like, are you getting people to follow Christ or to follow you?
Yeah.
Like what, you know? And again, listen, like, however the gospel gets spread, fantastic, in however, quote, large or small amounts, but it's not the number. Like, one soul, Therese is a perfect example. It's the quality of the soul, not the number of people that follow you on whatever. You know?
Yeah, right. Like, who's famous? Mother Teresa, who hopped off a train. And she wasn't planning everything. She was like, oh, look at these poor people.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a really big question. I have a hard time answering, because I'm a male, and the what you're addressing here in our Catholic Church, it treats women and men differently. And critics will say, well, how come the women do not have offices and positions of authority in the hierarchy of the church, and how that's, you know, they should be ordained. The Episcopalians are ordained. Women should be deacons. I'm in diaconate formation with my brothers, and and a lot of them bring, it's expected that deacons and deacons' wives go to formation together, because that's almost an implicit office, the wife of the deacon. And my wife is a Protestant. For one thing, she's got to watch her small kids. But like the idea that, there's a deacon and then there's the wife of the deacon, it's different. It's not the same. And I don't know how to answer people who say like, well, this is a patriarchal, unjust church. And you've thought a lot about it. What do you say?
Well, for one thing, I think of Mary, who was crowned Queen of Heaven and Earth by Christ himself. And I'd say, how can you say the church does not honor and venerate women? I think all the teachings of the church around marriage and family, which is really the heart of everything. I mean, it's how the Gospels begin, the star rising on the Holy Family, are absolutely geared toward protecting and cherishing women and children. And it may be because I've never been involved. Yeah, I'm Mary, like, reading and lighting a candle in my little prayer corner. So I'm not involved in church kind of administration or politics or anything like that. And perhaps I'm not, don't feel the difference so keenly. But I mean, just what you just said, Chris, I'm forming for the diaconate, and my wife isn't there or isn't being, because she's tending to the children. And I think the problem is that we ourselves, and that includes most especially maybe women, and I mean culturally, secular culture in the church, why don't we value the raising of children? Why is that not equal to or greater than the position of deacon? It's that we don't honor sufficiently, to my mind, what women, like the crown of womanhood, which is motherhood, and women themselves, in our quest for power, property, and prestige. And I think very understandably, I mean, that's part of the fall. It's part of our, hey, wait a minute, what about me? But I personally, I don't need to have, like, my mind is nimble enough to see a man on the altar and to understand that he's speaking on behalf of, for, through all of humanity. I don't see a priest and think that means I'm oppressed. Like, I don't make that about me somehow. I see a pastor. I think deep in the human heart is our parents, right? The father. Men are stronger than women. They're taller than women. They have a different psyche. I think, to me, great. I want a shepherd, a pastor. I don't have any problem with God the Father. I just don't. It's not, this is the stuff that, Chris, that my heart is always, oh my gosh, why am I such a horrible, why am I so judgmental? Yeah. Why am I so mean? Why am I so insanely self-centered? Oh, look, this is the stuff that comes up in prayer. It's not like, why can't I be a priest? This is just me. It's, oh my gosh, I've been judging this person. I can't, all they do is waffle. They can't make this decision back and forth. For gosh sakes, and then I realize, oh, I'm doing that. I'm doing that with this issue in my life. That's why it's the purification of the heart. It's how can I lay down my life for my friends? Like, okay, this morning I get an email. I had written this, I write for Magnificat, and I'd written a piece about this wonderful man. I think he's a servant of God now, Father Emil Capon, who was a chaplain, I guess, army, and got captured by the Japanese and literally laid down his life for his friend. Incredibly moving, heroic. And this guy had read the piece, emails me, had looked far and wide for my email. Thank you so much for your peace. And I'm praying to Father Capon for the healing of my cousin, Peter Cristalli, or something like that. And I just, that's my life. Like, I get to be, that's my way of being a priest. That's my way. Do you see what I mean? Like, who cares if a man, woman? I have so much, many more pressing things that press on my heart and that fill my heart with joy. So that's kind of where I am.
Well, and you've done a lot of that with your writing and your columns and your speaking. There's a lot of people who we will never hear about who do it daily with people they know and love, and you know, meet on the bus and meet in the street and help in their profession somehow. Okay, so I want to just read a question that I got from, so people can always send questions to almostgoodcatholics@gmail.com. And one listener named Amy here in California asked about the pronoun he. The catechism tells us God has no gender. He is God. So that's, you know, he is God, but he has no gender. And Pope Francis says God is both father and mother. And, you know, we know that God created us in his image, male and female. He created them. Do you have, is this an interesting question? Do you think this is?
Do you want to say, refer to God as it?
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, I don't know. Just for myself, I don't need the world to self-refer back to me every second. I don't need them to recognize me specifically. I mean, the catechism also, I mean, clearly the Trinity, it's God the Father. It's, to me, let's move forward with that and see what we can bring, what kind of love we can bring into the world. So, yeah, I don't mean to minimize other people's concerns. And if those are their concerns, that's fine. All I can say is it's just simply not remotely a concern of mine, that kind of picking apart of the language or insisting the language.
Yeah. Well, and you and the other women we've mentioned, St. Therese, Flannery O'Connor, we could add Dorothy Day or Mother Teresa. There's so many women who just started working without anybody's permission or say so, and did very holy things. So what is the role of a 21st century feminist of great education and intellectual ability in this 2000 year old church of ours?
I don't know. You have to find one. No, but your point is well taken. And those are the people, those are the women that I just revere. Listen, the church has been watered by the blood of the martyrs and the saints. It ever has been, it ever will be. So that's my question. How can I move toward that? And the women that you named, Dorothy Day, Mother Teresa, Therese of Lisieux, so many others, Flannery O'Connor as a lay person, Carol Hauslander, another great friend of mine, companion. They took the church as it was. The church gives us the body and blood of Christ. I mean, that to me, it's somehow managed to safeguard that for 2,000 years. That's really all and the guidance of the teachings. It's like, what do you want? It has given us the body and blood of our Lord, that I should be worthy to receive that. So you go out and you take whatever your gifts are, and you take that out into the world, and you don't make a federal case out of it, and you just do it. And it's very, very difficult. I think this is one reason I don't feel, quote, oppressed, because if you live, just as in whatever your station, but it so happens mine is childless, spouseless, celibate, obviously, because I'm single for many years, and a writer, a Catholic writer in the world. So meaning a lot of most of my friends, well, I'll say a lot of my friends are not remotely Catholic. Some of them are, you know, too polite to say so, but sort of virulently anti-Catholic. So, to be a Catholic in the culture, not in a religious order, not protected sort of, or, with a place of sanctuary, I will say, in a particular community, that is not for the faint of heart.
Mm-hmm.
And to stay true to the church and try to bring Christ into the world. I mean, it's so, the results, quote unquote, are so meager, and again, this is Therese. Therese was, no one knew who she was during her life. No one. So it just, I think, and everything in the gospel supports that, you know, be a servant, and many who are last shall be first, and the one who serves, and don't worry, your faith the size of mustard seed will become the tree, and the birds will come to dwell in its branches. So I think Also, one thing I wanted to mention is, you know, a lot of the times when I feel sort of oppressed or without power, or it's really because of patterns of my own behavior, say codependency, of which I have a huge, huge strength, you know, sort of people pleasing, being afraid to say, to kind of stand my ground, or to say no when I mean no and yes when I mean yes, you know, sort of passive aggressive, hard for me to communicate directly, to sort of say, and those are, I think working on that stuff has also given me a huge, that's what's quote empowering, because it's something within my own control. And it is also toward, as all true in quote empowerment is, it's all toward love. Love one another as I have loved you, said Christ. Christ was the farthest thing from a codependent ever. So I think
yeah, and you explain how he understood women.
Yes.
Loved women.
Totally. He totally got us. He got our hearts. This is one of the greatest moments in all of literature to my mind. Speaking of women and Flannery O'Connor, she has this story, Good Country People. And it's Hulga, who's this intellectual. She's been to college. She's an atheist. She's a sort of, oh, please. And she's home. She has a wooden leg and she's home with her provincial mother and her mother's gossipy, sort of simple, stupid friends. And she's a virgin and this traveling Bible salesman comes along and she thinks, oh, I'm going to take him up to the hayloft and seduce him. She does the thing that so many, and I am foremost among that, you know, I'll just sleep with someone who's kind of stupid and then, you know, whatever, that will give me power and I'll have power over him because he's too simple to understand my sophisticated, you know, whatever. And she gets the guy up in the hayloft and he's like a bumpkin or presents as a bumpkin. They kiss. And literally in the next moment, she's like imagining what her wedding dress will look like, you know. And that is, you can rail against it. You can say, I'm not like, but that is, we are made for that. And I think it's something to be proud of. You should love the person that you're about to give yourself to. And he should be committed to you, ma'am, because your heart is going to be crushed, because that's certainly how I was, you know. Yeah. I would kiss the guy and then like, you know, become obsessed with him. So anyway, I think that, and that's one way literature holds a mirror, really good literature holds a mirror up to us and to our human condition.
Right, because there is a deep wiring for relationship and vulnerability, and Christ got that with the Samaritan woman by the well and so on, or?
So many times. The whole Martha, Mary, you know, we all have that split in us. Women absolutely are called upon, and, you know, somehow we end up setting the table and putting the flowers out. And what that is to me is beautiful, but it's a huge, you know, every time a man wants to become a quote woman, I just think, oh, you're not strong enough to be a woman, you know, because Amen. Really a woman, it's unbelievable the strength it takes to do what Mary did, stand at the foot of the cross while her son is being tortured to death on it, you know, and in a sense, that is what women are called to, you know, we're called to hold this tension of, I think, always wanting more deeper relationship with the man, as Mary longed for, I'm sure, from Jesus, you know, and he's kind of like, who is my mother and my brother?
Yeah, right. why were you looking for me?
He's like, yeah, don't worry. I'm going to crown you queen. I mean, she absolutely honored her, but at the same time, that's a woman's heart. We always, I think women want to, you know, we want to sit down and like talk, yes, and men are always like, can we not talk, please? You know, that too, it's that split in the Garden of Eden, and to hold that without being resentful, without jockeying for power, you know, while owning our own power, but not wanting the power of the other. It really is a huge task. And I think the church absolutely supports us 1,000%. It says, go out and spread the gospels to the end of the earth, however that's given to you. And it's often, as you say, within our own families. I mean, the vast majority of the time, that's where it is, our own families, our own communities. And I think to just have a sense of mission about it, that this is important work, even if no one in the whole world recognizes it, Christ sees it, God sees it.
That feels to me a tremendously important point, and something that I think it's hard to articulate about the Catholic Church, because we believe that Mary is the Queen of Heaven, and we have such a strong Mariology that outsiders will say, like, well, what is this? Is this idolatry? What the heck is going on? Where do you get these traditions from? And like you pointed out earlier, nobody knew Saint Therese of Lisieux during her lifetime. Well, how do we know these things? How are these things, the participation of the communion of saints, the importance of Mary in heaven, how do we even know these things except for through revelation and something that's hard to put your finger on because it's not written on paper and you can't point to it? How does the church tradition work? Do you have a feeling of how these things are revealed, or how, I don't even have the words for the question, but like, how do Catholics know the traditions they have, whereas other people are much more empirical?
Yeah, no, that's a great, exactly. And that's the church, and it's centered on the Eucharist, on the transubstantiation, how it's the confluence of this world and the other world, you know, and the kingdom. And I think, right, you can't write it on paper, you can't write a scientific theory, but it is written on your heart. And the way you know is that you begin to live your life in accordance with it, and your life, and you begin to be transformed in some way that is mostly completely invisible to the world, and with all your, most of your faults intact. I think the one thing that you cannot argue with is the martyrs and the saints. How do you, quote, explain them in any kind of human worldly sense? It doesn't make sense. And yet they lay down their lives. And, you know, again, to your question of gender language and all that stuff, I had this moment. I went to Rome several years ago. They were having a synod in the family. And because Dorothy Day had gone during Vatican II, she took like a tramp steamer and like fasted. And I was like, you know, what am I going to do? I'm going to fly. Like, you know, but I like did my thing. Yeah. I fasted in my way. And I just wanted to be there in Rome. And I would walk along the banks. Like I wasn't drawn to, you know, like St. Peter's and all that. I mean, it was great, but so many people, so I would creep along the banks of the Tiber. That was my place down by the river. And I come across the, it's called the island of something or other. And on it is the Church of the modern day martyrs. You can walk over to it, San Bartolomeo. And you go in this church and there are chapels, I'm going to like weep, you know, of people from our time, under the communists, under the Nazis, in Latin America, in Africa, people who laid down their lives, who were killed hideously in many cases. And it's like, I just fell to my knees and just, please, Lord, help me just to touch the hem of these people's garments, you know? And that's what it is for me to be a member of the church. Like, it's like that I really should be able to worship at the same altar is just beyond everything, you know? And so again, yeah, it's a religion really of the heart. You can't explain it. You can only, you know, attraction, not promotion, as we say in that. And if people are, I think if their hearts are hungry enough, they will be attracted, you know.
Yeah. What kind of practices do you have that connect you to the transcendent, to the community of saints? I woke up early this morning and I prayed the rosary. And how do I know How do I know what it means? How do I know I'm not just sitting in my kitchen? How do I can't see the, unseen. How do you navigate this world with one foot in the invisible cosmological?
Mm-hmm. Yes, totally. Oh, tons of ritual. You know, somebody asked me not long ago in reference to my celibacy, you know, how do you deal with not having touch in your life, for example? I'm like, oh man, you should see my place. It's, I mean, my home is just filled with, you know, first of all, bird feeders, you know, lots of color and cards and icons and statues and prayer cards. And I lit a candle before speaking to you today. But I get up, I light my candle, I light my incense, and I pray the divine office is the first thing I do. And then I read that day's liturgy and I reflect on it a bit. And then I sit silently. You know, I have a whole prayer thing. In other words, I'm a super morning person. So, and I will often spend, you know, an hour or two. And I might be sort of puttering around a little bit in between feeding the hummingbirds or something. Mm. But I think, you know, candles, I think, are very important. You know, I mean, all this stuff resonates with us. And then I always have a rosary with me. So I'll pray the rosary every day somehow or other. I try to make it to daily, I make it to daily mass as much as I can. There's a Newman Center nearby that I'm actually going to go to after this because they're having a little get together for the lay people there. But and they have 5 p.m. evening prayer followed by mass, which is lovely. They also have a Blessed Sacrament chapel, and that's something I am being drawn to, I think, more. You know, I'm kind of a contemplative. I'm also super like, let's get a list and check stuff off. and get out of my way. You're too freaking slow. You know what I mean? Yeah. I don't have time for your chit chat. So, you know, and then I think it's some kind of evening prayer, some kind of examine, you know, how did my day go? Where did I go off the rails? Forgive me, help me. Please, you know, even like kneeling by the bed, you know, even now I lay me down to sleep, some kind of, please bless my sleep. And then during the day, I've been trying to say maybe noon prayer or midday prayer from the, or rather mid-afternoon prayer from the office, like that. Yeah. And then of course I write about, you know, my whole work life is really around that. And a lot of it's answering emails from, you know, I just hear from all kinds of different people through my blog, through my writing. And that's part of my kind of discipline and also of my extended community, I suppose you could say. So the mystical body is front and center, for better or worse.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And if and the world is noisy and clamorous, but it doesn't compete with your attention, that you're never in danger of missing out on those offices, or?
Oh no, of course, you know, I certainly am, but I think because I literally would get up I'll just get up at 4:30 or something like that. So it's kind of ready-made time that presents itself too.
Yeah. I'm the same way.
Yeah. And I often think, oh, that's God. You know, I think if you spend enough time in prayer, you know, that verse where Christ says, could you not sit with me for an hour, is really one of the most poignant ones when he was in the garden at Gethsemane. And you get the sense after a while, oh, maybe he likes spending time with me a little bit too, you know?
Yeah.
Unbelievable as it may seem.
Right. That's so central. And I think we miss it often through our busy, noisy lives. Well, Heather King, what an honor and a pleasure it is to spend this hour with you this day. And would you please say a blessing for our listeners?
Oh, how beautiful. Okay, Lord, thank you so much for bringing Chris and I together. I want to bless his work and his family. And all you listeners, let's just work together, knowing that we are praying for each other working toward loving one another as Christ loved us, and working to spread the gospels to the ends of the earth. And thank you so, so much for being with us today.
Amen.
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 Nails, spear shall pierce him through the cross. Be born for me, for you, and hail, hail the Word made flesh, the Babe, the Son of Mary.
Chris Odinitz and Heather King recorded this conversation on February 5th, 2022, the Feast of St. Agatha of Sicily.
Our music, What Child Is This?, is by Josh and Margot from the band The Great Space Coaster. Find their music at www.gscoasterband.com. The image of the dog, our logo, is from a stained glass window at the monastery of Santo Domingo de Silos in Spain, and is taken with the permission of the Dominican Friars of England, Wales, and Scotland from their website, english.op.org. My name is Chris Odinitz. Please email me with comments, questions, ideas at almostgoodcatholics@gmail.com. Talk to you soon.
This is Christ the King, whom shepherds, God, and angels sing.